This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. I had a buzz. And there it is. It had gone. Hear the buzz? I'm really hoping that when I actually start moving, that buzz is going. It sounds like it's going away. Okay, good. Because if it didn't go away, then I was going to have to actually figure out what the buzz is. Because, you know, that would get really annoying. Not that I'm not already annoying enough. But having that kind of buzz in the cockpit here, that would get really, really annoying. It is episode 263. It is Thursday today. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow. Taking my dad grocery shopping at 7 o'clock in the morning tomorrow morning because he has an appointment with the audiologist at, I guess that's what hearing aid people are called, audiologists, at 9 o'clock, and it takes us about 2 hours. By the time, you know, we both putter around and we get checked out, get the groceries back to the house, yada, 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 that gets us enough time to kind of get things stashed and then go ahead and get him to the audiologist, get that taken care of, and get on the merry way. So it's going to be a little bit of an early morning tomorrow morning, but we're going to make it. And I have a confirmed appointment at this point. So next week, I'm getting the haircut. Gonna start living the life of an anonymous person again. So I think I've mentioned that when I get my haircut, I become anonymous. Not because I'm embarrassed or anything, but because I attract less attention. So, and that's fine too. That's just fine. Start the whole process again. It's interesting to me because I'm thinking. Theoretically, if I can get two of these books done a year, the next time I get a haircut, I will theoretically be working on book number 6, 5, 7? Finishing up book number 7? That doesn't seem right. I'm finishing up book number 1 right now. Yeah, no, that is right. I'll be finishing up book number 7. Which means I will almost be through the first opus. Because there's 3 opuses in this Windfall series. The first one is the Conviction Opus. And the next one is the Revelation Opus. And the third one is the Nightmare Opus. So, picking up words that are in the Second Coming. It's going pretty good. It's going pretty good. It's going good enough now I didn't know that there was going to be like a kind of a big exciting thing. I thought I got to do something, but that seems to come together, and so I kind of know what I'm doing for that now. So now it's just a race out. Now it's just a matter of writing it out and then doing the wrap up on the end and deciding all the particular pieces that I kind of want to dangle at the end. I already have my big tearjerker finish. I know what I'm going to do for that. I knew that shortly after I got the book started. I didn't know before I started the book, but I came across this thing right in my main opening sequence. I didn't intend it for there to be a tearjerker in there, and I just got writing this little passage, and then my hero goes down into this area, and da-da-da-da, and like, you know, I'm writing this, and all of a sudden I feel it go, and it's like, hey, there it is. Sometimes things are surprising when I'm writing. And then I had this, you know, this little tearjerker thing right at the beginning of it. And then it wasn't too long after I wrote that that I'm sitting there and I think it was, I don't know. Anyways, I'm working on something. I don't know. And this scene comes to me. And I'm thinking, whoa. Because it's going to be good. It's going to be one of those things that just slays you. Well, at least it'll slay me. We'll see if it will slay anyone else. My cousin is going to be in town next week. Well, near. He's going to be in Branson next week. So we're going to go and have dinner with them late next week. And for my haircut, to get my haircut for free, I actually printed out a bunch of books, and I'm going to get some books from him as well, which is what that connection was. Sorry, I'm bouncing around a little bit. I'm going to get my haircut next week, and so I ordered some books for my hairstylist, who takes your clippers and shaves me bald. It's not exactly a hard haircut. And so I sat down, and I was reading some pieces out of Grumpy Old Prophets, and man, I gotta tell you, that book, Knowing, that is on the crucifixion of Christ, it's oofda. I like it. I like it a lot. And I mean, a lot of the people who read it said they liked it a lot too. You know, so I think my daughter was the one who said it didn't quite hit it for her. She said, but I think part of the problem was I knew it was coming, and she said I was all tensed up. And so it's interesting, this business of hitting the moment, that it is not hard for humans to shrug it off and for it not to impact them. You know, your heart has to be open to begin with in order to hit. And if you've decided that, you know, you don't want stuff to affect you like that. And I just saw a car drive by where their trunk looks like it was busted and kind of bumped it up and down a little bit. And I thought, that's going to be my trunk in a little bit. But that's another story. I'll get to that in a second. You know, hitting the moment, it's a really interesting, interesting thing. Because it affects everybody slightly differently. But if people's hearts are open, there's a lot of similarities in being able to get to the moment. So, anyway, so now it's just a matter of me writing this thing out. And page 253, somewhere around there, and I've crested 70,000 words. I'm up around 73 or 74,000 words. And I think we're going to make it to 300. I'm going to be close to that, depending on how stretched I make this final big scene. But I think I'm going to stretch it a little bit. And I think it'll easily chew up another 10 pages, 15 pages or so, if not 20 pages by the time I'm done with that. And it will give me some good setup for next time. And then I have to have the wind down. And then I have to have a couple of structural overviews of what's happening in the greater world. And then I have to do the dialogue, you know, the big tearjerker scene, or the epilogue, big tearjerker scene right at the end. So, yeah, I think we're going to be pretty close to that 300 mark. So then after that, if it goes to 300, it's going to go to somewhere around 90,000 words. It'll be close to 90,000. Which means I have about 15,000 more to go by the time I finish up this week. So that's about 3 more weeks. So that will put me at the beginning of May. A couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks for editing. So that'll put me somewhere end of May, beginning of June. And then the real fun begins, because I have to build the cover, and supposedly I'm going to do one of these photo montage-y thingies with the smoke effects and all the alien planets in the sky, and I know what I want it to be, but now it's just a matter of seeing if I can do it. So exciting. So yeah. So then, of course, if that all goes well, then the next thing's going to be, oh, now I got to turn around and do it again. But I'm really enjoying this series because there's just so much I can talk about in this series. And stuff that's just happening in the world right now I can talk about. Because it's all about stuff that's going on right now. So it's good. It's good. We'll see. It'll be fun. Anyways, so that's going well. I did hear on my car, I had mentioned that I was in a car accident several weeks ago. The adjuster finally got back with me, and the settlement people got back with me, and they are, in fact, going to total out my car. Rats! But, you know, in that way, that actually is going to be okay, because they're going to give me, like, $2,200 for my car, and they said I can buy it back for about $310. And I got to talk to my wife, but I'm really seriously considering buying it back. The big thing will be, can I fix the trunk and get the trunk to where it will latch? And so one of my projects this weekend is possibly to see if I can get the trunk open, take the trunk lid off, and then take a sledgehammer to it and see if I can pound it back out to the point where I can get it to latch. Because if I can get the trunk to latch, I'm good. I will buy back this car for $307. I think it was $307 something. I don't know how they came up with that price, but they decided it was worth $307 and so many cents. Okay, that's fine. So given that the car still runs and runs well and I have good tires on it and it gets 30 miles to the gallon, that sounds like a pretty good deal to me, and the car's paid for. Because then I can pocket almost $2,000 and just save that for when the car finally gives up the ghost and just go buy me another car. So I'm thinking it's good. Anyways, this week, I had a friend, was reading a book called Zealot, and I didn't write down the author's name on my notes. But you can look it up. It's called Zealot. I had seen the book when it first came out, and I thought it looked interesting, but I kind of knew what he was, you know, going to be talking about, because I read some of the liner notes, and was like, yeah, I get you. But my buddy wrote and said he had been reading it, and he was really enjoying it, and suggested it might be something I'd be interested in, so I went ahead and downloaded the sample on my Kindle. It does sell for $6.99 on my Kindle. If it had sold for $2 or $3, I probably would have just gone ahead and bought it. But since it was $6.99, I thought, eh. To his credit, the guy seems like a good writer. But the sample got me through his preface and his introduction. And that was enough to go, okay. Now, I haven't read the whole book. I should say that right from the beginning. And I should also say I have no doubt that he brings out some very interesting things about the Gospels and about the times of Jesus Christ, because the book is about Jesus Christ. I have no doubt about that. But as I read his preface and his introduction, I just thought, yep, I know where you're coming from and why you're coming this way. Because it's fascinating to me how people work their way around to where they want to be and then sort of claim and justify that they're not working their way around to where they claim they want to be and try to paint themselves as different than what everyone else is doing as we all work ourselves around and get to where we want to be. So, by way of background, when this guy was 15 years old, he found Jesus, and he found it at a summer camp, you know, and one of those great summer camp conversion things. And he learned all the straight, you know, criteria, evangelical criteria, boom, 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 right down the line. He happened to be the son of Muslims. They were lukewarm Muslims. He had grown up in Iran. You know, but they weren't heavily religious. It was just like being Persian to him. And so he had never seen this kind of fervor before. And so that became a very welcoming thing to him. And in addition to that, he had since, his family had come to America, and, you know, Jesus was America to him. And so he got really fervent, absolute devotion to his newfound faith. He was going around, he was trying to, you know, get everybody he could, you know, he was a best friend, someone I could have a deep and personal relationship. He said, as a teenager trying to make sense of an indeterminate world, I had only just become aware of this was an invitation I could not refuse. And so, I mean, he was going around, you know, buttonholing people, trying to get them converted, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, he goes around, and the more he probes into the Bible, the more he starts, you know, getting a little doubtful and a little disillusioned. And, you know, he kind of starts finding out that, you know, there's not really much setting for the Jesus of history, and mostly what we know comes from the Gospels. And then he starts noticing there's some discrepancies, heaven forbid, there's some discrepancies between the Gospel accounts. And so then he gets into college, and, you know, all these doubts just go full-blown, because, as he says, the bedrock of evangelical Christianity, at least it was as it was taught to me, is the unconditional belief that every word of the Bible is God-breathed and true, literal, and inerrant. Source of this leads to a crisis of faith. And now he's confused and spiritually unmoored, and he has to rethink everything. And so then he finds some meaning in the culture of his forefathers, and then he eventually gets to study more, and he starts, you know, doing more historical studies, and he comes across textual criticisms and all those things, and begins analyzing, and the more he says that he studied about the Jesus of history, you know, the more genuinely drawn he was and became a committed disciple of the Jesus of Nazareth more than he was ever to the Jesus, the Christ. And he says the good news is that his hope is that in this book, to spread the good news of the Jesus of history with the same fervor that he once applied to spreading of the story of the Christ. Now, this gets to be really interesting, because I haven't read the book, so I would really like to know what good news he's spreading, because I don't think I will give it away to say that what he says in his introduction is that what he truly believes about the Jesus of history is that the Jesus of history was just another zealot like all the other zealots that were around at that time, who went too far when he went into the temple and upset the apple cart on everything and made the Jews mad, made the Romans mad. And, you know, the Romans crucified him because he was a zealot and he was an insurrectionist and he was stirring up trouble. And then everything ended. It was all over, all done. And somehow, after all that, even though he was just like everybody else who ever lived, all the other zealots who went down that path, ta-da, somehow this survived and actually spawned into this huge movement all around the world. So, okay, well, that's fine. And so what's interesting then is in his introductions, he has to go through and sort of set up that premise and defend it. And so he says there's a few things that we should keep in mind before we begin. He said, for every well-attested, heavily researched, and eminently authoritative argument made about the historical Jesus, there is an equally well-attested, equally researched, and equally authoritative arguing opposing it. So he's admitting right from the beginning that everybody is all over the spectrum on this. Now, to his credit, you know, he wants to primarily rely on the earliest gospels, because he said, you know, that's what's going on in the earliest gospels, like Mark, and in the Q sayings. And one of the things about Mark is I don't think, he said, in general, I've chose not to, Mark. These are the earliest, Mark and the Q material informing my outline of Jesus. That is because these are the earliest and most reliable sources available to life about the Nazarene. And he does mention somewhere, I'm trying to remember if the earliest versions of Mark even had anything about the resurrection in them. I'm not sure. I would have to look. Anyways, so he goes through all that. He does mention, and this is very interesting, so he says, the problem of pinning down the historical Jesus is that outside the New Testament, there is almost no trace of the man who would so permanently alter the course of human history. He says, the earliest and most reliable non-biblical source of Jesus comes from the first century historian Flavius Josephus, who writes in this brief throwaway passage of a fiendish Jewish high priest named Annas, who after the death of the Roman governor Festus unlawfully condemned a certain James, the brother of Jesus, the one they call Messiah. And quite rightly so, the author of this book says that that's really significant, because in an age when people were going by first names and so had to be located to a place so you know who they were talking to, i.e. Jesus of Nazareth, the fact that this historian had confidence that he could say James, the brother of Jesus, the one they call the Messiah, and everybody would know who he was talking about, means that by 100 AD, Jesus was really well known, and it was a movement, and it was going. So there's no question that Christianity was established at that point, and things were happening. He said the only other thing that we have, I'm getting my mail, is that we've got second century historians. Oh, mail must have already been picked up. Like Tacitus and Pliny the Younger, they both mention Jesus of Nazareth, he said, but they reveal little about him save his arrest and execution. So he comes right out, flat out, and says, basically, if you're going to sidestep the Bible, you really have nothing to go on. I mean, that's what it comes down to. You have nothing to go on. And he goes on later to say that, one moment. He goes on later to say, sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. You have nothing to go on. And he goes on later to say that, in fact, the search for the historical Jesus that was undertaken with such furor, I'm backing it in my garage, multiple years back, he said, that's pretty much all died down. And there are some people that even say that if you try to go after the historical Jesus, it really just becomes a matter of heart after a while, because there simply isn't anything there. Now, what's interesting is after he goes through all that and says all that, then he turns around and indicates that he's going to try to go after the historical Jesus, but for some reason when he does it, it's not going to just be a search of the heart. So, okay, well, that's fine. He does mention, he said that we do have a manuscript, Corinthians, that appears to be dated quite early. He said, you know, we have First Thessalonians can be dated between 48 and 50 CE AD, Common Era, some two decades after Jesus' birth. He says the trouble with Paul, however, is that he displays an extraordinary lack of interest in the historical Jesus. He said there's only three scenes that are ever mentioned in his epistles: the Last Supper, the crucifixion, and most crucially for Paul, the resurrection. Which is in an early epistle. Well, it seems to me that if the reason that Paul would display this extraordinary lack of interest in the historical Jesus or in telling the stories about the historical Jesus is probably because there was an agreed upon narrative about Jesus's life. And in fact, I believe that this Q narrative that was either spoken or was written down, that we think the Gospel of Mark was based on, and that Matthew and Luke also based theirs on, including Mark, that Q narrative that people talk about, to me, the fact that Paul does not rehearse narratives about Jesus' life is because he assumes that the people that he's writing to already know them, that it's common knowledge what Jesus taught and what he did. And so he doesn't feel any need, when he's writing his letters, to go over them, which would seem to indicate to me that what we have in Mark, you know, is pretty close to what those narratives were. And what we have in Luke, you know, Luke talks about the fact that he exhaustively researched and that he, you know, went down and chased things down and tried to write an accurate account, that in fact maybe there was stuff that Mark just didn't include that was in Q that Luke then did include, and that's where this extra stuff comes from. But honestly, this is all a matter of the heart at the end of the day. So, you know, so then he says, okay, so he's going to concentrate on Mark. He's not going to look much on Matthew and Luke because he feels like Matthew and Luke have actually corrupted things, because he believes that Mark is not actually written until 70 CE and that Matthew and Luke weren't each actually written until 90 and 100 CE. Well, okay, that's fine, but he just, like, states it as fact, whereas, you know, it would be nice if he actually said, you know, there is some disagreement as to when this were written, and actually go, and of course, maybe nobody that he agrees with is in disagreement with those dates, but I did some research, and there's discussions all over the board as to when these were written, that they could have been written decades earlier than that. None of that's really that important to me, because it seems pretty clear to me that, in fact, the Gospels were based on something that was around and that was common knowledge among the Christians. There was something that they had. Now, why it's important for him to move these back and date them late, 70 and 100, is because he has to get around what he feels are the corruption of the Gospels to the true nature of Christ. That, in fact, to the true nature of Jesus, because it's not Jesus the Christ, it's Jesus of Nazareth. Because in his mind, Jesus was a zealot. He was just a zealot. He wasn't this peace-loving person. He wasn't any of that. He just wanted to start an insurrection, and he pushed it too far, and they crucified him. But the reason that it's important for him to push them so far back is because he's got to get them after the destruction of Jerusalem, because that's his trigger then. The destruction of Jerusalem is his trigger, because that so demoralized the Christians in his mind that they went back, and so they repainted Jesus as a peace-loving person, not a warmonger, not a zealot, because they were trying to get the Romans to where they wouldn't persecute them, because they were afraid the Romans would come and get them. Well, you know, for my problem with that is that if Jesus was a warmonger up to that point, and then suddenly these gospels show up that say, no, no, he was peace-loving, and people would look at everybody and go, what? That's not the stories that we heard the whole time. And that kind of radical shift, I just don't think that's going to play out in a movement that's been going for 100 years and that obviously has some momentum behind it for the historian to say, James, the brother of Jesus, the one they call the Messiah. I mean, it's really kind of a pull for me to believe that that's actually what's going on, aside from the fact that it's just a little too convenient, you know, that we redate in order to get it past the fall of Jerusalem. But, you know, at the end of the day, who really knows? So what he says, the reason that he's able to do this is he says, so when combined with all we know about the tumultuous area in which Jesus lived, and thanks to the Romans, we know a great deal. These two facts, those two little dinky facts, help paint a picture. Wait, the two facts are by themselves, these two facts. In the end, there are only two hard historical facts about Jesus of Nazareth. Right. That we cannot fully rely on. The first is that he was a Jew who had led a popular Jewish movement in Palestine at the beginning of the first century. The second is that Rome crucified him for doing so. By themselves, these two facts cannot provide a complete portrait of the life of the man who lived 2,000 years ago. But, he says, here we go. Now, this is how, you know, he really sets things up. So, but when combined with all we know about the tumultuous area in which Jesus lived, and thanks to the Romans, we know a great deal, these two facts can help paint a picture of Jesus of Nazareth that may be more historically accurate than the one painted by the Gospels. Indeed, the Jesus that emerges from this historical exercise, a zealot revolutionary swept up as all the Jews were in the religious and political turmoil of the first century Palestine, bears little resemblance to the image of the gentle shepherd cultivated by the early Christian community. Okay, so he also says, I talked about that part already. So he says, this book is attempting to reclaim as much as possible the Jesus of history, the Jesus before Christianity, the politically conscious Jewish revolutionary who 2,000 years ago walked across the Galilean countryside gathering followers for a messianic movement with the goal of establishing the kingdom of God, but whose missions failed when after a provocative entry into Jerusalem and a brazen attack on the temple, he was arrested and executed by Rome for the crime of sedition. It is also about how, in the aftermath of Jesus' failure to establish a reign on earth, his followers reinterpreted not only Jesus' mission and identity, but also the very nature and definition of the Jewish Messiah. Okay, and so he's going to reclaim this, supposedly, by using higher criticism and looking at the historical time frame. And he says, if we expose the claims of the gospel to the heat of the historical analysis, we can purge the scriptures of their literary and theological flourishes and forge a far more accurate of the picture of Jesus of history. Indeed, if we commit to placing Jesus firmly within the social, religious, and political context of the era in which he lived, an era marked by the slow burn of revolt against Rome that would forever transform the faith and practice of Judaism, then in some ways his biography writes itself. The Jesus that is uncovered in the process may not be the Jesus we expect, but certainly will be the Jesus that most Christians, modern Christians, and he certainly will not be the Jesus that most modern Christians would recognize, but in the end, he is the only Jesus that we can access by historical means. Everything else is a matter of faith. Okay, that's... So he doesn't consider what he's doing to be a matter of faith, but he considers what everybody else is doing to be a matter of faith, even though he's only got two facts about Jesus, and he comes by divine fiat to a decision that Jesus must have been like everybody else. He just makes this statement that, well, since Jesus was in that environment, he was just like everybody else, and therefore he was a zealot just like all those other zealots, which to me... begs the huge question, then what happened. Because there is a fascinating question, or there's a fascinating approach that I forgot his name, and Axe stands up, according to the record, when they were thinking about, you know, killing John and Peter, and what are we going to do with these guys, and I can't pull his name. He stands up and he says, look, wasn't there this zealot that rose up and died? Wasn't there this zealot that rose up and died? Wasn't there this zealot that rose up and died? Wasn't there this zealot that rose up and died? If this guy's dead, he says, let's just not encourage him. Let's just let him go. Their leader's dead. The movement's going to die out. That'll be that. We'll be done of them. But if there's something else happening here, we may find ourselves in the position of fighting God. And all this talk about, well, we've only got two facts, and so what we're going to do is we're just going to look at the scriptures, and we're going to compare our very rigid Western mindset of historical interpretation and how the writers wouldn't say that, and they wouldn't say this, and we're going to, you know, take all our little textual criticism and go after it and going to rip it all apart according to our Western analysis, and what's left, then we're going to say, see, Jesus was like everyone else in history. Yeah, well, honestly, if Jesus was like everyone else in history, I don't think we would be where we are today. There was something else that was profound and different about him. And I don't know if I should actually really get into this next topic, but this business of the evangelical Christianity stance is that every word in the Bible is literally true and literally God-breathed, and by extension means that every word in the Bible is literally good for doctrine. I know very few people that when they talk about the inerrancy of Scripture will actually go that far. You know, in my fourth book on grumpy old prophets acting, I dance dangerously close to getting some people upset about what I believe about inerrancy. Because I personally do not believe that every word of the Bible is so true and so God-breathed that every word should be taken and turned into doctrine. And somebody called me on that after reading that book and said, so do you believe Scripture is inerrant? And I said, I believe that all of the writers believed what they wrote when they wrote it, and I believe that God got across what he wanted to get across. Period. He got it accomplished. But I don't believe that just because a biblical writer wrote it, it means we should take it and turn it into doctrine by which we should live our lives. And the person I was talking to, their eyes kind of went up a little bit. I said, look, you already believe that too. I know you already believe that. Because you don't believe that when Paul says, I don't suffer a woman to teach in church, that we should really follow that. Of course not. That is cultural. You know, you don't believe that a man should have multiple wives, even though they did all over the Old Testament. That was cultural. It's historical, cultural. And people, when you really start talking to them, will begin backing away and say, no, these are historical stories. No, that's culture. You get into all these discussions about what's cultural, what's historical, what's real doctrine, you know, yada, yada, yada. I think the essential stuff that we needed to know about God is revealed in the Bible, and it's true. That's what I believe. But I am not going to get into a situation where I'm telling people that if the Bible tells you to hop on one foot for 3 days, you know, or, well, God told Elijah to lay on his side for 3 days, and that's the way we find spiritual enlightenment, so I should lay on my side for 3 days, and I'll find spiritual, you know. I mean, that's not what the Bible was written for, and it's not the... We take our Western mindsets and our analytical rigidity and we map it on top of Eastern mindsets. And having grown up in the East, having grown up in the Far East, I think I understand a little bit about how the Eastern mindset works. There's a lot of allegory in it. There's a lot of examples. There's some hyperbole. You know, I think Jesus was saying the truth when he said, you know, if your hand offends you, cut it off, or it's better for you to go in maimed than to go to hell. I think he was saying the truth there, but I don't think literally he was telling people, go cut off your hand. He was making a point. And it's so sad to me to see religious organizations push this rigid form of inerrancy when, in my opinion, the only reason they're pushing such a rigid form of inerrancy is so that they can then set up the rigid doctrines that they want to set up so that they can establish who's in their club and who isn't in their club, and they can point fingers and condemn anyone who doesn't believe exactly like they believe. And for me, that is not the point in reading and believing what the Bible says is true. The point of reading and believing the Bible is to cultivate a closer relationship with God and Jesus Christ, not to come away with a club that you can beat people over the head with. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.